Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Building our infrastructure with American-made materials. New guidance issued by the White House. Nurses on strike in California for one day. The issue? Lack of personal protective equipment. And today on the show, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers and the West Central Florida Labor Council. Welcome to the Tuesday, April 19th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Melissa Cropper, longtime supporter of America's Workforce, is going to be our first guest on the show today, and she is going to report some good news about a union win. Educators at Menlo Park Academy in Cleveland, Ohio, voted for the union 46-3 to become the ninth Cleveland area charter school to join the OFT's Cleveland Association of Charter Teachers and Staff. They overcame an intense union busting effort and a challenge, a frivolous one, to the NLRB's jurisdiction to actually hold an election. The union busters will do everything possible to deny and delay. Melissa says the group organized to improve their working conditions and their students' learning conditions and to be able to work with management as equal partners. And we're going to get into details on that, how they were able to overcome those union busting efforts. We're also going to talk about some legislation, HB 616, which is in the Ohio legislature, and Melissa says it's an attack on Ohio schools, on students, and educators in a legislative session that she says has been filled with extreme overreaches that would allow politicians to micromanage the schools. This one is the most extreme. It bans certain books, prohibits teaching of certain concepts, limits what can be used as continuing education credits for educators. It also includes a more expansive version of what they just passed in Florida, the Don't Say Gay bill. That's generating a lot of controversy all around the country. We're also going to talk about STRS. That's the State Teachers Retirement System. And there's a couple OFT members running for seats on that board. And it's my understanding they finally added a cost of living to the teachers that retired. That's certainly good news. There's another issue here, and that is the difficult task it is to attract substitute teachers. And we know the pandemic, and I've said this on the show many, many times, has changed everything in America. There's a lot of workers and jobs, frontline workers, that say, you know what, I'm not getting paid enough to do this, and I'm not going to get sick. I'm sorry, I'm just not going to go down that road. Well, what's happening in the schools, and Melissa addressed this on the show a number of times throughout the last year, there's a lot of teachers that are leaving the profession, and they don't feel safe on the job. And that means they have to bring in substitute teachers. Well, they don't have enough substitute teachers with the right college education. So what they're doing, they're cutting, or at least trying to cut, college degree requirements for K through 12 substitute teachers. Now, they did this when the pandemic hit, and we're still in the pandemic, mind you, and it was deemed as a temporary solution. But you know how that goes. They might want to keep this going. And this is kind of a catch-22 because we need teachers. We need teachers, but we don't want to lower the standards. This is going to be an interesting conversation. Sean McDonnell will be joining us later on the show, and he comes to us from the electrical workers local in Tampa, Florida, 915, and he is president of the West Central Florida Labor Council president. They got a lot of issues going on in Florida. One thing we're going to get into is a city center project. This is a big deal, $108 million proposal to build a complex to house hundreds of city workers. This is in East Tampa. And apparently, this process is raising a lot of questions. When city leaders announced this project, which was last March, they pitched it as a way to bring economic activity to the area, which is an impoverished area, predominantly black, lots of poverty. Now, some questions are being raised by a number of construction officials, labor groups like Sean's, about whether the city is following its own bidding and apprenticeship rules. Ooh, we've got some problems there. We got some problems. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about organizing top down, bottom up, different methods of both, which works better. We'll get into those apprenticeship programs. We'll talk about politics. There's an issue, too, that we're going to get into that would weaken Florida's public sector unions. This bill is HB 1197, and it would create barriers for most of Florida's public sector unions. It would require those unions with a membership of at least 50% to recertify on an annual basis, which is a very cumbersome process, and it's costly. It'll hurt the union's financial coffers, which is obviously what the right-wingers are trying to do. So we'll touch on that as well with Sean McDowell, again, West Central Florida Labor Council president. Well, we got some good news out of the White House yesterday. You know we got a very pro-union, pro-worker president. Well, the Biden administration is taking a key step toward ensuring that federal dollars will support U.S. manufacturing by issuing requirements for how projects funded by the bipartisan infrastructure package source their construction material. New guidance was issued yesterday requiring that the material purchase, whether it's for a bridge, a highway, a water pipe, or broadband internet, all of that, to be produced right here in the United States of America. However, the rules are also setting up a process to waive those requirements in case there's not enough domestic producers or the material costs too much, with the goal of issuing fewer waivers over time. That is something we've addressed on the show many, many times, especially with Scott Paul of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Get the products in America first. If they're not there, I get it. You got to waive it. You got to waive it. There are going to be additional opportunities for good jobs in the manufacturing sector. That comment from Celeste Drake, director of the Made in America program at the White House Office of Management and Budget. And she comes from the AFL-CIO. Good person there. The president hopes to create more jobs, ease supply chain strains, and reduce the alliance on China and other nations with interests that diverge from America's. With inflation at a 40-year high ahead of the midterm elections, he's betting that more domestic production will ultimately reduce pressures, price pressures, to stop GOP attacks that this relief package initially triggered higher prices. Comment here from the president. From day one, every action I've taken to rebuild our economy has been guided by one principle, and that is Made in America. It takes a federal government that doesn't just give lip service to buying American, but actually takes action. Biden said that the roughly $700 billion the government devotes annually to procuring goods is supposed to prioritize U.S. suppliers, but regulations going back to the 1930s have either been watered down or applied in ways that mask the use of foreign imports. And that's got to come to an end. The administration could not say what percentage of construction material for existing infrastructure projects is U.S. made, even though the federal government is already spending $350 billion on construction this year. The new guidelines would enable government officials to know how many dollars go to U.S. workers and factories. And tucked into that package, we're talking about the infrastructure package that became law last November, was a requirement that starting next month, May 14th, none of the funds allocated to federal agencies for projects may be spent unless all of the iron, the steel, manufactured products and construction materials used in the project are produced in the United States. That's according to the guidance that came out yesterday. It includes three standards for those requirements to be waived. Number one, if the purchase would be inconsistent with the public interest. Number two, if the needed materials are not produced in sufficient and reasonably available quantities or of a satisfactory quality. And lastly, if U.S. materials increase a project's cost by more than 25%. So just saying made in America isn't good enough. You need rules and regulations. And hopefully, now that we have this in place, we're going to see more jobs pop up in the manufacturing sector to make the supplies that we need for our infrastructure. Buy American. That's what it's all about. Good news there. Thousands of nurses went on strike yesterday morning across the Northern California-based Sutter Health System. The nurses have been in negotiations for a new contract for over 9 months, with Sutter continuing to, get this, rebuff demands for additional protective equipment, safer staffing practices, and then higher wages for experienced workers. You'd think by now they would get this right. Got a comment here from one nurse. She said, "We are striking because Sutter is not transparent about the stockpile of PPE supplies and contact tracing. They resist having nurses directly involved in planning and the implementation of policies that affect all of us." That strike involved about 8,000 nurses and went for 1 day yesterday. That was it. As 8 Starbucks locations have had NLRB certified union elections, with more than 200 filing paperwork to engage in a vote, the CEO, Howard Schultz, who actually came out of retirement to fight the union, has announced that the company may be offering certain benefits only to non-unionized workers. How about that? The Wall Street Journal reported that Schultz stated Starbucks cannot unilaterally change the compensation of unionized workers, so extending the benefits to them would be illegal. He also took the opportunity to note that people who might be voting for a union don't really understand, let alone the dues that they're going to pay. Starbucks Workers United had stated in late March that it anticipated Starbucks would soon announce new benefits to undermine worker organizing efforts. So they're ready. They're ready for the assault. Let's put it that way. All right, quick break. When we come back, Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And, of course, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go down to Columbus, Ohio right now and join one of our regulars, also a supporter of America's Workforce. That would be Melissa Cropper, who is president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. And she has been busy, and we've got some good. It's always good to start off the show with good news. And we have an organizing win at a charter school. And this is the ninth Cleveland area charter school to join the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Melissa Cropper, you have to be a happy camper today. How are we doing?
Extremely happy. Like I said, it's always good to have good news, and this was a tough fought battle, and just really proud of our educators and staff at Menlo Park for, you know, withstanding all the union busting that Menlo Park Academy tried to do, and, you know, standing up for your rights and organizing and winning this victory by a vote of 46-3.
Overwhelming, no doubt, overwhelming. So let me ask you a couple questions here. How long did this take when they said we need a union to the point where they got that vote of 46-3? And I want you to talk about the techniques that the union busters used in this one. Go ahead.
Sure, sure. You know, in the scheme of organizing, it doesn't seem like an incredibly long time, because I think we started working with them in September and we got the vote March 30th. Having said that, it went that quickly. It only went that quickly because when they came to us originally, over half their staff was already on board with wanting to organize. You know, a lot of times we'll get organizing requests and we'll start out with 4, 5, 6 people. We have to grow it. But this union of about 50 people, I think they had like 27 people at their first meeting. So that just tells you how determined they were to get a union. And so we were pretty quickly able to get everyone on board, but then the union busting tactics started. So it was the mandatory meetings so that the administration could tell the educators how horrible unions are. It was the public comments made in board meetings and stuff about how having a union was going to raise costs and potentially make them have to, you know, close their school. Their biggest delay tactic was they filed jurisdiction charges. So they challenged the jurisdiction of who we have to organize under. So there's been a longstanding court order that charter schools are organized under the NLRB, and Menlo Park challenged that, which delayed us. Let's see, we filed in December and didn't get to vote till the end of March. So that's what really delayed us the longest, was waiting for a decision saying, no, it does fall under the jurisdiction of NLRB. Again, this was just a delay tactic on their part, because there's been a longstanding court order that it works that way, and they were just trying to stall the election. And then during that time, multiple emails, especially even including after we got the court decision, those days leading up to the election, numerous emails from Menlo Park administration just saying, you know, we won't be able to give you the raises that we intended to give you. We won't be able to do this. We won't be able to do that. So just constant putting threats and fears and trying to put threats and fears inside people's heads. But every time they did something like that, it just made our people grow closer together and grow more determined to make sure that they got their union.
I want to talk about this challenge to the labor board. And you noted that this was a frivolous challenge. They probably, what this sounds like to me, Melissa, they knew they were going to lose. This was purely a delay tactic. Am I assuming that correctly?
Well, that's what we firmly believe, that this was a delay tactic, because we were pretty clear that if we lost this challenge, then that would simply mean that we would file under CERB and hold our election there. So one way or another, we were going to hold an election and become a union.
I see.
This just delayed the process. So that's why we think they did this as a delay tactic, because they knew one way or another we were going to file somewhere and we were going to win because we had the votes to do it.
Also, the working conditions were an issue. What do we know about the working conditions there? And the other part of this question, too, is the teachers wanted to work with management as equal partners. I mean, come on. We're all in this together to educate our children. What's the problem here?
Right. Right. Exactly. I mean, that's one of the things we always try to put in our contracts, is some kind of labor-management partnership where where teachers and educators and other staff members can come to the table and help in some of the decision-making process. So that it certainly is part of the issue, is making sure that, the educators have more voice. Issues such as when I went up to the board meeting one night and talked with several of the that are now members, things like, you know, 2-3 maybe even a week before a school year starts, not knowing yet what classes you're going to be teaching. Now, in a teacher world, that's huge. I mean, the summertime is when you prep and get ready and, you know, plan out your school year to plan all summer long to be teaching one thing and then go in a couple weeks before school starts to find out, oh, no, you're not teaching eighth grade this year. You're teaching second grade. That's
oh,
a huge difference. So it's things like those kind of decisions like that the educators and staff really want more voice in. And, of course, you know, pay is always an issue, especially in these charter schools. They pay horribly low salaries. So that's always a factor in organizing decisions also.
Okay, good vote there. Again, 46-3, joining the union, the OFT, at Menlo Park Academy in Cleveland. And that, again, is the ninth Cleveland area charter school to join the OFT. Okay, now for the negative news here, and this is House Bill 616, which is pretty much an attack on public schools. And I was reading, you know, Melissa, when the Ohio Chamber of Commerce weighs in saying this is not a good bill, it must be horrible. Holy moly.
It's not often that we're on the same page. I know.
Talk to me about this one.
Well, this bill is just so extreme. I mean, many people may have heard of Florida's Don't Say Gay bill. This is that bill on steroids. It's really raising, what it's doing is it's raising a lot of, it's playing into the fears and anger of a certain segment of our society and trying to pretend like things are happening in our schools that just simply aren't happening. But it gets at restricting what teachers can teach in a classroom, but in such a subjective way that is very dangerous. So to say that you can't say anything that is divisive, you can't teach anything that includes diversity, equity, and inclusion outcomes. And who defines divisive? Our State Board of Education, well, they can't agree on anything right now. So,
they think
equity is divisive. We've been talking about needing equity in our schools for years. So, so that makes it dangerous. But it even goes to the degree of saying that teachers cannot take certain courses for re-upping their license. I mean, that has never happened before, where the legislature is making a law about what classes we can take for renewing our license. That's just an extreme overreach, in our opinion, of what the legislature should be doing.
Amazing. I see you have a group, Honesty for Ohio Education, a coalition, and they're basically doing some outreach on this, I take it?
Yes, Honesty for Ohio Education is a coalition that's been working probably around a year now, since House Bills 322 and 327 first draft, about making sure that the public understands what these bills are doing and making sure that we're saying that, you know, we want our schools to be places where students learn about the history of our country in an honest way, and mm-hmm. that we're learning how to have civil discourse about things that have happened in our history, and that we are promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion in our classrooms so that all students feel safe and welcome and put on a pathway to future success.
Makes sense. Well, what's your gut tell? With the Chamber of Commerce going against this, do you think that it has any chance of moving forward? What's your gut telling you?
You know, I'll be honest with you. What my gut is telling me is that the intent of this is not necessarily to pass it. The intent of this is to be able to be used in commercials and political ads to create more fear and division going into an election cycle.
There you go.
So,
yeah,
who knows when they'll ever actually even put it in a committee and try to pass it. I think they're just going to try to keep ginning up this fear, this anger, this divisiveness, so that they can push their right-wing candidates and try to create this division between parents and teachers. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the terminology they're using around all this, is parental control, parental control, parental control. And I think what's important to push out to people when they're seeing these commercials and stuff is that, you know, parents, teachers, schools welcome teachers in the classroom. that for years we've been saying we want parents involved in their children's education. And that happens at a local level. Parents come in and talk to the teachers. You know, if there's something happening in the classroom and you want to know more about it, you're not happy about, talk to the teacher, talk to the local administration, et cetera. But no parent has the right to decide what all the other children in that classroom learn. And that's where, you know, again, what this comes down to is educators, professionals, following standards, determining what's happening in a classroom based upon their professional expertise, and not caving in to a few individuals who think they might be offended by something that someone on some right-wing media outlet told them is happening in the classroom.
Yeah, yeah, and they get all the media attention on doing that. All right, let's move on to the state teachers retirement system. And this needs a little explaining because I remember you talking to me maybe a month or two ago that the retired teachers have not gotten a raise in a long time. Now, I'm reading they did get a raise, but that's only a one-time raise. Can you give me the details on this, Melissa?
Yeah, I mean, it gets kind of in the weeds and complicated, but basically there had been a freeze put in 2013, a freeze was put on COLAs. So anyone who retired in 2013 would not get a COLA for 5 years. And then I think it was in 2017 that freeze then applied to everyone. So basically, the way it stands now is those people who had not gotten a COLA prior to 2017 who went there 60 months, as the current statute says, you have to go 60 months without a COLA. Those people will now get a 3% COLA for this year. I mean, that COLA will stay with them, but it's not another 3% next year and 3% next year. Just this year only, a 3% COLA will go into effect. So it's only for anyone who retired prior to, I think, July 1st of 2018. Anyone who's retired since then has to go 60 months before they will receive their COLA. Now, we're running two candidates for the state teachers retirement system. Julie Sellers on the active side and Liz Walters on the retired side, because we believe firmly that all retirees should be receiving a COLA every year. And in addition, we want to see a change back to our active teachers only being required to work 30 years before they can retire instead of 35 years. So, you know, there's differences in opinion on how things should happen at the STRS board level, but we're running the two candidates that we think will ask the tough questions and push the system in the direction of making sure they're fiscally sound while giving members the best benefits possible.
Get the right people on the board, in other words. Yeah, makes sense.
Yes.
Makes sense.
Yes.
One more here, and we're running a little bit tight on time, but this is something we could pick up in future shows. And this is kind of a catch-22 because you and I have had several conversations about teachers leaving the profession, especially with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And many of them got sick, too. And they said, you know what, I'm not getting paid enough. And we've seen that across the board all throughout the country. But apparently, with so many teachers leaving, you have to bring in substitutes, and there's not enough substitutes. So apparently, our lawmakers are thinking, well, we have to lower the requirements, maybe not a college degree. This was kind of like a temporary fix during the pandemic, but that temporary kind of scares me, and Melissa, it probably scares you as well. What's the story here?
It does. It does. This has been a difficult topic for us. This is House Bill 583, I believe, that basically it extends what the provision that was put in during the pandemic that basically allows anyone over the age of 18 to be a substitute teacher. That is quite scary to us for multiple reasons. There are skills and expertise that are needed in the classroom, even on a daily basis, and even more so as you get into long-term subbing. We understand, though, that we are in extreme times now where our teachers are being overburdened, overstressed because they're having to cover other classrooms or take more students into their classrooms. So we know that there needs to be some kind of temporary fix. Don't think this bill went far enough. There was another bill that's being proposed that put a lot more parameters around it. Would have rather seen that pass. think the key here is that we have to make sure that this doesn't extend beyond 2 years. I mean, the fear is always that once something's put in place, everyone says, oh, well, it worked for 2 years, let's just continue it.
Yeah.
And that can create all kinds of harm in the system. So we were successful in getting an amendment in that bill that says that a study commission is supposed to be put together to determine why people aren't subbing at this point in time and to try to figure out more ways to get subs in the system. So we need to take that piece seriously, try to figure out what we do to attract high-quality subs into the system, and then make those changes so that when teachers are absent from school, there's some continuity of education happening for our children with people who not only have content knowledge but understand how to manage a classroom and how to keep children safe.
Got a real simple answer. Raise the pay. How about
raise
that?
Raise more. And I think there's a little more than that. I think there's something around benefits there, too, which you've gone with pay. But,
exactly.
Yeah, make sure. Yeah, exactly. make it a place. You know, make it better to come there and work than to go to McDonald's and work.
There you go. All right, we're going to leave it on that. No, we got a lot of ground covered today. Melissa, great job, as usual. Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, oh.aft.org, proud sponsor, one of the many proud sponsors of this show we call America's Workforce. You take care. We'll talk to you in May, okay?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, quick break. When we come back, we're going down to Tampa, Florida, and we're going to join Sean McDonald, who is president of the West Central Florida Labor Council.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, we are available on at least 6 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just do this. Sign up. Receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those 5-star ratings, so please keep them coming. Let's go down to Tampa, Florida right now. Joining us on our live line, well, I'm hearing all kind of noises in that line, Sean McDonald is with the West Central Florida Labor Council. He's president, and he's been president for the last 4 years, and he comes to us from the Electrical Workers Union, IBEW Local 915. Their website is IBEW915.org. And they have just over 1,100 members in the Tampa area. Sean McDonald, welcome to America's Workforce. How are we doing today, my brother?
Thank you, Ed. We're doing great. Thank you for having me today.
Okay, my pleasure. And I'm sorry that you have to deal with the politics down there. It seems like every day Florida's on the front page, or we're hearing about it on various broadcast outlets. But let's talk about, and I want to get into what your legislature is doing. I'm reading about how they want unions to recertify, especially public sector unions. But talk to me a little bit about the West Central Florida Labor Council. What territory, how many counties? Can you get into the details for me?
Yeah, sure. We represent over 12 counties, which consists of over 100,000 working families. And as you said, yeah, the legislature here, it's always been predominantly Republican-based. And with the man at the helm right now, Governor DeSantis, he's using it as a platform for him to basically run for president. All the shenanigans and all the legislation they've been passing this session has been just basically propaganda and pretty much just going to be commercials for when he runs for president. It's a shame that they were given two tasks this session, and that was redistricting and getting the budget passed. And unfortunately, they were too worried about things like, you know, don't say gay and union busting bills, and they didn't even get the two things that they were tasked to do to get done. They did finally pass the budget, but they're still working on redistricting. So you're absolutely right in what you're saying.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I refer to that as a bunch of noise. And let me ask you this question. I mean, you represent a lot of people down there. And I'm sure you have had many conversations with your members. And I'd like to know what they're saying about this. I mean, do they tune this out? Are they believing it or what? What are you hearing?
Well, the members that are active within our labor council are very in tune with it. You know, the rank and file, you know, they just go to work every day and, you know, some of them get caught up in the whole minutia of the federal, you know, the who's in the White House, and that's a shame. Uh-huh. But we try to get them focused on local politics and state politics, because that's where the business and the work really gets done. And that's kind of what we focus on. As a matter of fact, we have something that we do in Tallahassee called Working Family Lobby Corps, where every week of session, we send up we don't just send up, we get volunteers from all the individual local unions to actually lobby on behalf of the working people. It works out really well for us.
Good, good, good. How's the organizing going on down there? I know this is a right to work state, but you know, that can't stop you. What's the status?
No, organizing, you know, the IBEW, that's kind of what I was brought into the office for originally from the field, was to be an organizer, and that's what I truly enjoy doing, and that's what we do on the regular here in my office. And pretty much the environment dictates which way we're going to go. You know, if like right now we have a substantial amount of people on the out of work books, so we turn our focus on top down organizing. So, you know, we'll look at organizing contractors. We'll look at you know, who's got want ads out there. We'll go to that office and we'll see if we can, quote unquote, help them out, you know, with their manpower issues. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, with the manpower issues that we've had in this country, we've actually had contractors reaching out to us because they know the quality of a journeyman that we turn out. So they've actually been coming to us, and it's, I don't want to say it's been easier, but it's been, I guess, a little bit easier.
Now, I note that when it comes to organizing, there's top down and bottom up, and there are different methods. How do you figure out which way to go? I'm kind of wondering about that.
Well, basically, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, and that is, you know, it's basically the environment. Right now, we have a lot of guys in the auto work list, so we're working on contractors, but the top-down philosophy. And when we have a manpower shortage, we're out there on job sites, you know, on non-union job sites, talking to workers, trying to get them to join the union. We have tools like a contact book that shows all the advantages of being a union member. And one of the things that's in that contact book is a page on non-union dues, because that's one of the things we face a lot. You know, we have to inoculate the worker on all the anti-union rhetoric they hear from their employer. And it just blows my mind that some of these guys buy in and ladies buy into that stuff, because, you know, why would the employer be telling them all these bad things about a union when there's really they're talking about $40 a month for union dues and then a little bit of an assessment for the hall when you're looking at they're paying for their own health care, they're paying for their own pension, and we've got three of them. So I pulled that page out, and it's about $11 an hour they're losing in benefits. So
Do you tell them what the union busters generally make? I had a story, and I'm sure you followed what was going on with Amazon at Staten Island. Union busters there were making like $3,000 a day. And the workers over there, they exposed their pay. They exposed them individually. Do you do any of that over in West Central Florida?
we don't get too many, we don't get too many union busters in this area, but you know what? That's news to me. That's something I'm going to look into because that's some really good information to have. $3,000 a day. I did not see that. That's really informative. Yeah.
Altogether, Amazon spends, I think, $3 or $4 million a year. There were some stats on that. I don't have them in front of me right now. I want to say it was like $3.4 million last year just on busting unions. And they've been successful. And you know it's going to be a tough road to hoe, especially for those folks getting a first contract. That's always difficult. But they'll have a lot of things thrown at them. But we'll follow that story. Getting back to what you're doing down there, how's your apprenticeship programs doing? And if you could speak to especially the high school kids, because there's a lot of young people today that don't realize what they can make in the trades, especially. And I know you come from the electrical workers. So what's how's that looking down there?
Yeah, our apprenticeship program, I can speak for the electrical, the IBEW. We're actually, we're busted at the seams right now. We've got almost 300 apprentices enrolled now. We do approach the high schools. We've had counselors come to our building trades meetings to try to get the counselors involved. And then we found once you get the counselors involved, they want to get the parents involved. And then once you get the parents involved and the parents see the pay structure and the benefit structure and what it can lead to, they're the ones that push the kids to get in the trades. And as you said, I was a product of, my father was IBEW for 65 years. My grandfather was in the railroad up in Chicago, and they wanted me to go to college. They pushed me to college. I went that route. I got the big college, loans and all that fun stuff, and ended up going right back to the IBEW because the degree did help me. It helped me to progress in what I'm doing now. It's an awesome way to make a living. And I'm working. We work now with local municipalities on trying to get apprenticeship ordinances passed, responsible wage ordinances passed, and that's just pretty much to, level the table, level the playing field, get a seat at the table, and get our apprentices the hours they need and the experience they need to become journeymen.
That's a big issue when it comes to responsible contracting. Are you having success in the various municipalities that you're working at?
That's a great question. We're having success because we have success in getting local folks elected that are friendly to labor unions. But the rub comes when the enforcement of it. We had a problem in St. Petersburg. Of course, the ABC sued the city of St. Petersburg over our apprenticeship ordinance and lost. And then we now have one in the city of Tampa, a huge project. And we've got a contractor in there that seems to be running the show and seems to be trying to find every loophole they can. And we try to explain to the city, the importance of this, and they just don't seem to get it. And we're trying to work with them. And, so in answer to your question, we're having no problem getting them passed. It's an enforcement tool.
Exactly.
The procurement part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what good is a law if you can't enforce it? I mean, it's
right.
It's not a good law. It's not a working law. Oh, that's
and then the flip side of it is going back to Tallahassee and going back to that whole mess. They just do preemption bills. They just preempt it to the point where anything, if a business owner feels like it's impeding on his business, he can actually sue the city and recoup his money and freeze the bill or freeze the ordinance. And they just think they can do whatever they want up there in Tallahassee. So it's a constant fight down here.
You got your hands full, my brother. You got a lot on the plate down there.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Sean, can I hold you for another segment here? I got some more. I want to talk about this city center project. I've been reading about that. Can we get into that?
Sure.
Sean McDonald is his name. He comes from the electrical workers. That would be a 915, IBEW 915 in Tampa, Florida. And he is president of the West Central Florida Labor Council president. We'll be back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
A great union requires a reliable election system. Survey and Ballot Systems is a trusted election partner with more than 30 years of expertise in managing union elections. By partnering with SBS, your union can ensure it gets an auditable process and a high level of customer service. SBS is here to help you conduct your union vote securely, transparently, and with trust building always in mind. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Iron Workers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 iron workers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union iron workers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our iron workers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Sean McDonald on behalf of the West Central Florida Labor Council, and he's located in Tampa, Florida. I was reading about this City Center project, and this is a proposal to build a complex to house hundreds of city workers in East Tampa, and I guess it's in an impoverished area, and obviously when you do that kind of thing, you want to stimulate the economy in there, but apparently there's some problems, and I know you're in the middle of this, as it should be. We got to get the labor voice in there. Sean, explain to our listeners what's going on there.
Well, there's been some questions about how the project was awarded, and us personally, the labor council, the building trades, we're not really that concerned. I mean, we are concerned about the way it was awarded, but our main concern is the apprenticeship ordinance once again, and that apprenticeship ordinance being followed the way it was written. And that's what I'm working on with the help of other building trades members and other folks, other stakeholders, because you have a project like this, and you're told from people in the city that this is going to be the creme de la creme of the apprenticeship ordinance, and then you come to find out that a contractor like DPR, who's worked well with unions throughout the country, but then comes to Florida and turns its other cheek to unions and to the apprenticeship ordinance, it just befuddles me, and I just that's where I'm at with it. As far as the minutia of how it was awarded it, who approved it, I don't really have enough insight on that. And apparently it was done correctly. So that's where I'm at on that right now, currently.
Can you give me some more details on this company? It sounds like they have a good reputation in Florida, but they're cutting some corners down there. Am I hearing that correctly?
They sat here, they came to our union hall. We had a nice conversation with them like we always try to do. We try to get out in front of things. So they came to our union hall, talked to all the building trades guys, actually sat there and told us, hey, we're not the cheapest, but we're the best. And we said, hey, we got something in common. We're not always the cheapest, but we're the best, best trained, best, the safest, you know. And the very next day, they awarded the steel erector project part to a contract that has no state-approved apprenticeship program. The very next day. The boldface lied right to us, and then I approached them about it, and they said, it was already awarded. We didn't do it the next day. So, that was their excuse to me. So, I don't have any trust in them, and I'm trying to work with the city right now, still trying to get this worked out on the weekly. We have weekly meetings. Try to do it through council. Didn't get anything done there, so we're still trying to do it. Still trying to work with them.
Well, hopefully we'll come to some resolve. How many jobs are we talking about once they move forward with this?
You know, unfortunately, I haven't been privy to all that information because it's been real tight-lipped. I mean, we've actually gone out to the job to, try to take measurements and outside the job area to try to see about maybe doing a day of action out there. And, man, we got the guy quickly approached us and kind of accosted us at the fence line. So it's been a real tumultuous job site. And even our contractors that are bidding it, you know, I can't get a lot out of them. So it's a huge site. It's a $110 million project, multiple structures. Like the core and shell wasn't even put out to bid, went right to the non-union. So we're trying to stay on top of it. We're doing the best we can. And that's pretty much what I know about it.
Yeah, you just got to stay on this issue. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got a contractor bid it, so we'll see what happens.
Let's talk about the legislature here. And I was reading that there's an attack. There's some legislation that's titled HB 1197, which would primarily target your public sector unions in Florida. It would require them with membership less than 50% to recertify on an annual basis. And I know this is part of a national push. They would like all unions to recertify after a certain amount of time, like maybe every year. If you have a 3-year contract, you got to recertify every year. Can you tell us, does this have legs? Is this happening, or what's the story?
Well, it seems like they try to push this, I don't know about nationally, but every year in Florida, they're trying to push this. And we fight it every year, and it's one of the things that's really good for us. And President Williams with the state, AFL-CIO, instituted this Working Family Lobby Corps. And that's something that we're on every year. And it does, it could have legs if we didn't meet it every year head to head. And it would be detrimental to the teachers union, to public sector union folks, like you said. And we know what their angle is. Their angle is to attack the largest public sector, the largest union entity. So then, you know, it would affect the AFL-CIO as a whole in the state of Florida. And then they could start whittling away at that, the private sector unions as well.
Sure. Yeah. Union density in the public sector is like 30% and like 6% in the private sector. So it's understandable that they're going to go after that majority. Makes sense. All right. One more question here before you go. I'm just wondering how we're doing trying to get the right people in office. And I know a number of states have done this very, very well. New Jersey, for one, and the AFL-CIO nationally has done a pretty good job in promoting. Even they have toolkits to tell union brothers and sisters, people like yourself, say, you got a leadership position. Maybe I got to get involved in the legislature. So, you know, make things more worker friendly. How is that looking in the state of Florida? I know it's a tough state, but you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, we do. We do have exactly what you said. We have the toolkit, and even in the West Central, we have farm teams. My executive director, unfortunately, handles more of that than I do. But I know we have an iron worker down in South Florida who's in the state legislature. So we do have some up and coming folks in Florida. But we do work closely and tightly getting others that are very familiar with labor elected in the position. We are just, you know, one thing we got to do is we have to try to keep the ones that we get elected in office and try to get to stop them from jumping from one position to another one, or maybe get stop three of them from trying to go to jump up to maybe Senate or something like that, if you know what I'm saying. So we can keep our numbers where they're at, you know? But I hear what you're saying there, and that would be great. But we need to start them. We also need to start them smaller, you know, maybe, you know, school board and work them their way up instead of just going right for, you know, state representative or state senator, you know, because some of them want to jump right in there, and they need to start out small. It's kind of hard to tell people that, though.
Bottom up. Yeah, they want everything right away. I understand.
You can't just be a state representative. You know, you got to start it. You got to get a little something behind you first.
Get a little experience under your belt. I get it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Sean, great job today. Thank you for joining us here. First time on America's Workforce. I want to keep in touch with you. This is a key state. It's a bellwether state politically. We all know that. Sean McDonald, president of the West Central Florida Labor Council, also with the IBEW, IBEW915.org. They have about 1,125 members in Central Florida. You stay safe and stay strong and stay in touch, okay?
All right, thanks, Ed.
All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the American Federation of Government Employees and the Sprinkling Fitters out of Chicago. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.